Okay, welcome to this session, A Place Called Utah. Presenter is Parker Blount, and I'm Brad Hess, and I've been asked to introduce him. Parker has told me that he's just an old boy from Georgia. I coaxed some more information out of him. He's a retired faculty member from Georgia State University. His field was educational policy studies. He's a native Georgian and a lifelong church member. And with that introduction, I'll let Parker tell us about his insights.
Thank you. I really would like to just get right down there amongst the group and go through this paper. This taping thing throws us off a bit, but you know, listening to Robert Kirby and his humor, I worried the whole time, you know, so how am I going to be an exemplar for one of his articles now? Well, I fit in the category. But, and then I also thought, well, if push comes to shove, could I take him? So, all right, the title of my paper is A Place Called Little Utah, with a quote from a novel, one character speaking to the other, who says, quote, "What is man," said Athos, "who has no landscape, nothing but mirrors and tides," end quote. When the sea we now call the Atlantic Ocean receded, it left behind what in Georgia is called the coastal plains. It is a landscape of sandy soil, often as fine as sea salt, cypress swamps of tea-colored water, rivers snaking their way to the ocean, and savannas of scrub oak and yellow pine now dotted with farms. It is a beautiful place, but a tropical paradise it is not. The Gothic emerges from its nature as effortlessly as the cottonmouth water moccasin glides among the cypress knees of the misty swamp. The summer days linger with the temperature and humidity hovering at nearly the same level, and the insects are legion. It is a geography and climate that shapes lives according to a long list of Southern writers and poets, including the likes of William Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor, Robert Penn Warren, and Sidney Lanier. That was the landscape of my youth. I grew up like most of the South Georgia boys of my day. We were barefooted all summer, in and out of the creeks and rivers, swimming and fishing, working in the fields for money for school clothes. We went to fish fries and barbecues, and on Saturdays, we went to the show, as we call the movies. Most of us went to church, and there is where my life differed from my associates. I was a Mormon. In the South, one is first and foremost a Southerner. It isn't something one consciously constructs. Rather, it is the byproduct of the way geography shapes culture. On the other hand, in the LDS Church, one is first and foremost a Mormon. Our allegiance and loyalty in our little congregation was to the LDS Church, but we could no longer escape being Southern than the coastal rivers can escape the rise and fall of the tides. You can choose to be Mormon, but you can't choose to be a Southerner. But little did I realize in the 50s that by choosing to be a Mormon, we would, in time, have our indigenous Southern culture supplanted by a stronger, more dominant Utah Mormon culture. Our little congregation emerged on the coastal plains landscape on January the 9th, 1905, when Morning Davis was baptized along with her daughter, son-in-law, and three others. They formed the nucleus of a branch of the church that officially was known as the Satilla Branch, named after the river that flowed nearby and the place of baptisms for many years. In time, the Satilla Branch became the Axon Ward of the Jacksonville Stake, the first stake organized in the South. But among locals, members and non-members alike, the church was known as Little Utah, or Utah Church, or simply Utah. It was called by those names because in that area of the rural South, all the churches, regardless of the denomination, had names. One didn't just attend the Baptist Church, for example. One belonged to Pisgah, or Mount Zion, or Bushy Creek. Thus, Satilla Branch was Little Utah, and the Douglas Branch of the church, some 20 miles away, was Cumorah. In many respects, Little Utah was another Southern country church, though the doctrine was LDS. It was shaped by the same forces of geography that shaped other churches of the South. And its story, like the story of other churches of other denominations, is the story of a place and the interaction of the place and the people of the place. It is primarily a story of belonging. But the biography of Little Utah is also, is the story of the loss of place in the modern LDS church. To understand the story of Little Utah, it is important to understand something of the South. People are not entirely wrong when they say that north, east, and west are directions, but south is a place. And in the South, place is important. One indicator of the importance of place is the concept of home place. Harry Cruz, in his A Childhood, A Biography of a Place, wrote, quote, "I come from people who believe the home place is as vital and necessary as the beating of your own heart." Continuing, he says, "Such a place is probably important to everybody everywhere, but in Bacon County, Georgia, although nobody to my knowledge ever said it, the people understood that if you do not have a home place, very little will ever be yours, really belong to you and the world." End quote. Even when the home place was no longer in the family, it was still talked about, driven by, and kept alive through memories. It was a source of identity and belonging. Or as Eudori Welty has written, quote, "There may come to be new places in our lives that are second spiritual homes, closer to us in some ways, perhaps, than our original homes. But the home tie is the blood tie, and had it meant nothing to us, any other place thereafter would have meant less, and we could carry no compass inside ourselves to find home place, home ever, anywhere at all. We would not even guess what we had missed." End quote. Much of the work of the small southern farm of the last century was solitary work. So the southerner of that day learned solitude, and with that solitude there came, for many, a spiritual and reverence for a world larger than self. They were not without their gregarious nature, and as opportunities arose, they gathered together and told stories. Southerners aren't the only storytellers, but storytelling is particular to the way of life demanded by the southern geography. All of us who are old enough and lived in farming communities have childhood memories of sitting on someone's front porch, listening to the adult tell stories to the background music of night creatures and the steady rhythm of rocking chairs and the distinctive frog-croaking creaks of the porch swing. Those southerners told stories to break the silence of their lives, but they had learned to live with the silence and in the silence. Of course, solitude can turn on you and produce meanness, and there was plenty of that in the South. But I'm speaking of those who learn from solitude that life has its rhythms and that most things will wait on you. So in a hot country, the art of conserving your energy is highly refined, including even how you modify your speech. All of that influenced their belief in and approach to God. Mormonism, on the other hand, grew up in the cool climate and protection of the mountains, producing an energetic faith and over time, I would argue, governance as firm as the mountains around us. At the turn of the last century, that growing, restored church was introduced to the Deep South. There in that hot and languid country where the passion for the cloven tongues of Pentecost runs as hot as the 4th of July, or perhaps the 24th of July, which is even hotter, pockets of acceptance were found. For the first few years, most of the converts immigrated to the West, mainly the San Luis Valley in Colorado. When the call for immigration ended, permanent congregations were established, and for over half a century there was a southern version of the church, warm of heart, slow, perhaps sluggish, and a bit charismatic that contrasted with the cool and energetic western version. The difference was not in doctrine, even though there were probably instances of differences in doctrinal interpretation. This was, after all, a land where grace predominated. The difference can be seen as a reflection of climate and geography. Life could be hard in the South where the climate could sap your strength before us. They loved God, those Southerners did, but they had made their peace with Him. It consisted of a consensual agreement of not making too many demands on each other. The LDS Church, however, has a way of making lots of demands upon people. Ironically, in a small place like Little Utah, the demands increased where the prescribed church jobs remained constant, regardless of the available numbers to fill them. But somehow those slow-speaking folks found ways to deflect many of the demands. They did it not because of a lack of testimony, but from, I think, a deep belief growing out of their solitude that worship and religious practice was inevitably private and personal. Out of the personal and private view of worship grew a certain independence that is collectively reflected in their church buildings. The construction of a meeting place in the rural South was a fairly simple affair. A group of like-minded worshipers decided they needed a place of worship, so they built one. They constructed a building in terms of the resources and knowledge that was available to them. The church buildings typically consisted of a simple rectangular structure, often with only one room. No matter how plain, the buildings reflected the resources available to the congregation in meeting their needs for a place of worship. Perhaps more importantly, though, it reflected their independence. They didn't need anyone's permission to build. In the year 1886, my Baptist professing great-grandfather became the pastor of a country church set deep in the coastal plains of Georgia. The Jones Creek Baptist Church was founded in 1810 when 21 men and women wrote and signed a church covenant. It reads in part, quote, "We the inhabitants of the vicinity of Jones Creek do covenant and agree in a solemn gospel engagement to give ourselves up to God and to one another, to walk together in the fear of God and in Christian love one with another," end quote. They built a small meeting house that served them for several years until they outgrew it. Quote, "Henley Foxworth Holm, a member of the congregation, submitted a design for a large box-like building, and after some deliberation, his plan was adopted," end quote. Money was raised and the building built. The building, a simple frame construction, was much like the church I call mine. The history of Little Utah is similar to Jones Creek. Those LDS converts wished to have a place to meet and worship. In the spring of 1905, just months after their January baptism, Morning Parker Davis's son-in-law deeded 2 acres of his 600-acre farm to the church for the construction of a building and a cemetery. The building, described as rustic, served as both a church and a school. When the building grew too small, a new building was constructed on the site in 1918. Though plain and simple, this newer building reflected the enlarged membership and its increased resources. Still, it was a reflection of that community of saints and their larger southern context. I have a friend whose family moved into a small rural southern town during the early 50s. There was a small LDS branch there, and my friend's father was called to be the branch president. One of the first things he did was to release the sister who had served faithfully and well for many years as the branch clerk. His father served for only a short time when employment took him elsewhere. One of the first actions of the new branch president, a longtime member of the branch, was to recall the sister as branch clerk. The independence reflected there is related to where I'm going with this essay, but it isn't the trail I'm attempting to follow here. Rather, it has to do with my friend's father, the branch president, calling the church building department in Salt Lake, more firmly established by now. He sought help regarding a problem associated with the building. "What building?" he was asked. "We don't own a building in that place." "That may be," he said, "but we meet in it every Sunday and have for years, and everybody in town thinks it belongs to the Mormon church." Apparently, when the church was constructed, no one knew that you were supposed to deed it over to the church. I relate those instances to suggest that the LDS congregations were not different from their Protestant neighbors in some respects. What the Mormons of both of these southern communities and the Baptists of Jones Creek knew was they needed a place to meet. They desired the association of like believers in their pursuit of salvation and a place in which that association could take place. They didn't feel they needed anyone's permission to build a meeting house. With that came a sense of ownership. It was their place and their place of worship. In that context, both individuality and independence in worship and belief flourished. That desire to join together with others in communal worship is obviously not confined to any geographic region. People of like minds come together every day and establish meeting houses where they can worship as they believe. It just doesn't happen in the LDS church any longer. That fact, I suspect, shapes our conception of the purpose of our church buildings and the nature of our worship there, indeed, if we worship at all. But for us at Little Utah, we were grounded in our religious life by a place. Ray Ellis, an artist who has painted many scenes of the tidewater low country of Georgia and South Carolina, named one of his paintings Morning Prayer. It is the interior of a southern country church. There in the interior of the building are two women seated side by side, dressed in their Sunday best, hats included, in the otherwise empty of people building. The two women, embraced by the diffused early morning light, are dwarfed by the building. The place looms about them with its unadorned, handcrafted simplicity, yet their presence brings life to the painting. They, sitting there in solemn reverence, are the representation of life that includes sacred intentions. Their presence gives life to the building, just as the building gives life to them. They worship and are the embodiment of worship in a place of worship. Both they and the building have separate biographies, yet their stories converge. clearly places our biographies just as people do. The building, the literal physical structure of my country church and the grounds upon which it sat, the members who attended, their faith, testimony, their conception of trust and reliance on God, their view of the sacred, all tied together to make up the church biography. When I first saw the Ellis painting of the church interior and the two women in the painting, I became intensely aware that my story is embedded in the story of my country church. One of the beliefs I took away from that church, though it was slow in emerging, is revealed by an aspect of the Ellis painting. It is the absence, and in my mind, the conspicuous absence, of the pulpit. Ellis simply does not show that portion of the building where the pulpit is located. He paints those areas where the people congregate, the pews and the pot-bellied stove at the rear of the building. I can't say what Ellis had in mind, but my interpretation is that both by way of the title, Morning Prayer, and the absence of the pulpit, he is saying that there is nothing or no one between the two women and God. They are in their sacred place, petitioning the Lord in the purest and simplest way. It is primal individual worship, but with community hinted at. And there is, of course, a larger congregation of which the women are a part. They, each member of the congregation, have voluntarily come together in their individual pursuits of the sacred, belief that they will benefit individually by sharing collectively. The church is a building and as an institution exists for the congregation, not the other way around. The church is not that which is worship, though it may be love. The function of the church is to facilitate the individual's pursuit of salvation. There should never be confusion between the individual's primary role and the church's supporting role. In time, I came to love the little white frame building that was unique and distinctly ours. The building itself meant more to me than a place to attend church or a place to be instructed in the ways to live the Mormon life. It was the embodiment of a belief implanted there that my spiritual growth was my individual domain, though I could join with others in a collective effort to know and understand God and His plan of salvation. But my individual responsibility for spiritual growth, for knowing God's will for me, could never be subjected or abdicated to a group or an institution or another person. The flow of my church cultivated a current of belief that our worship was defined by ourselves. In those days, at Little Utah Church, headquarters and church leaders were far away, and consequently the influence church leaders exerted was different in the South from their Western influence. The president and the prophet was held in high esteem, and the concept of 12 apostles was an underpinning of the truthfulness of the church. But the person of the 12 apostles played a less important role, with the exception of LeGrand Richards and Charles A. Callis, who both served as president of the Southern States Mission. Another difference, also a result of distance, was the belief, structural and cultural aspects of temporal participation. Temple marriage was perceived in some sense to be of value, but few managed it. For those couples that had been to the temple, it was later in life, and they went, and it was a one-time trip. Where possible, the children were also sealed at that time, but that didn't always happen. In this regard, the membership of the ward was interesting. In almost every case, one spouse of each couple in the little ward was a convert. Marrying outside the church was the pattern, and it reflected not so much of testimony as the way geography and the larger southern culture negated aspects of the Mormon belief system. That is, for the most part, farmers and the sons and daughters of farmers. The farm life and the community growing out of it had its own way of forming relationships that transcended the marriage guidelines that would come out of Utah. In the absence of temple, there was also an absence of annual temple recommend interviews with the bishop and state president. Consequently and significantly, there was less of an emphasis upon allegiance to church leaders and church procedures as there is today. Although we sustained the church leaders at ward conference and state conferences for those who made the 200-mile round-trip journey, they were, as I have said, removed from our lives. Somehow, I believe we thought we determined our needs and how to meet them. At the time, I am not sure we would have understood having everything programmed at church headquarters in Salt Lake. Mainly, the church in the South was perceived as a vehicle, a tool, and an implement in ways less defining and demanding than it appears today. That is, the focus was upon, to use scriptural phrases, trusting in the Lord, relying upon the Lord, walking with the Lord. The heart of the matter was what existed between the individual and God. And the stories we told were different from the ones you would hear in the center stakes. The stories we heard as youngsters were the stories of human nature in the context of hunting, fishing, and farming. What we didn't hear were stories about ancestors crossing the plains, since there were none. There were not stories about missions, since none had served missions. There were no ancestral stories of pioneer life. There were no stories of Uncle Heber or Uncle Golden. The only church stories we heard, and they became increasingly frequent as I grew older, were those included in Sunday school and priesthood manuals. There could have been stories about Morning Parker and her descendants and others, but somehow they were squeezed out over time, being secondary and paling in importance to the main story. I graduated from high school and went away to college in the West, BYU. There were Mormon churches on every corner, but none of them looked like mine. I went on a mission, returned home, resumed college, graduated, and went to graduate school in the Midwest. Somewhere in the midst of all of this, I realized that once you had seen one LDS church, you had seen them all. I began to wonder how you could develop any feelings at all for your place of worship when it looked like every other place of worship. Where was the attachment? At the same time, Main Street USA was becoming increasingly standardized. There are streets in every town of any size that are duplicates of one another. They are the one where the franchise eateries and chain store businesses locate. They are the lookalikes. They are the streets where you can be lost and at the same time be on familiar territory. They are the streets where you can walk into a store and realize that you could be any place in the country and now the world. We are left with what the Israeli geographer David Newman refers to as the, quote, McDonaldization of the world's landscape, end quote. What do these places offer us? They give us the comfort, assurance that there will be no surprises. The products we receive will vary little no matter where we are. So when we travel across country, we see the familiar signs of, say, a fast food establishment. We already know both the menu and the taste. There is the comfort of no risk. But there also will never be intimacy with place, for we will never love our Burger King. We may love Burger King, but there will not be our Burger King that will become the subject of our memories and stories. With that, we have lost part of our identity. It seems to me that the church has traveled a similar road as Main Street USA. Here, then, are some similarities between what I see happening in the church and on Main Street, or actually corporate America. There is, of course, a similar strategy in both the church and corporate America of having identical-looking buildings. They serve the purpose of being easily recognized no matter where you are, and, of course, having standardized building is economical in time and money. In the case of the church, it also eliminates the possible problems of local congregations from getting out of hand. For example, this program curtails, if not eliminates, the problems that would arise between the haves and the have-nots. It has the appearance of being a more egalitarian program. Another similarity between the church and corporate America is their management strategies. In the corporate world of chain businesses, the planning is done at the corporate office by the major officers of the building, of the business. The products are selected at that level, and they will not vary from store to store. There are few decisions to be made at the store level. At the store level, the manager basically manages inventory and people who handle inventory. The manager makes sure there is sufficient inventory, the centrally approved merchandise, and that there are sufficient employees to distribute the product. The work at the store level tends to be routine and consists of following directions. If everyone follows the guideline from headquarters, then the expectation is that the store will be successful, that is, profitable. In the case of the church, all lessons, meetings, and programs are planned or outlined in Salt Lake City. At the stake and ward level, leaders implement the programs with few degrees of freedom to vary from the prescribed program. Few decisions are made by bishops and state presidents beyond staffing the programs and carrying out the specified meetings within the specified time format. They are essentially the managers of a corporate-owned store. So we attend meetings in our respective congregation where the format is the same. In sacrament meeting, the speakers have more often than not been assigned a topic. We attend classes where we have recycled lessons, and all of this is done in meeting houses that all look essentially the same. Not only do our buildings look alike and our services follow the same pattern, but so do the members. We look alike, and we dress alike, and we talk alike in almost every way. There is little diversity among those who regularly attend LDS meetings. Those who are different either conform or drift away. The system seems to be suspicious of and have little tolerance for those who are different. They are then institutionalized with standardized program where one size fits all. If the program doesn't fit, the individual or congregation needs to change. We have reached a point where we have no voice in our church activity, let alone ownership. To be sure, we are encouraged to be close to the Lord so that He can guide us in our personal lives and in our church assignments. But because of the repeated admonition that one should never seek a position or calling in the church, along with the directive that one should never turn down an assignment or calling from the bishop or other priesthood leaders, we have effectively curtailed personal inspiration. We have in actual practice made inspiration the purview of someone else in that larger area of our lives that is under the umbrella of the church. Upon reflection, it seems strange that we have prohibited the Lord from revealing to the individual how he or she is to serve. I am reminded of Wendell Berry, who has written so much from his farm in Kentucky about place and community. He said, quote, "Most modern churches look like they were built by robots without reference to the heritage of church architecture or respect for place. Modern Christianity has become as specialized in its organization as other more modern organizations, wholly concentrated on the individual shibboleths of growth, counting its success in numbers, and on the strange enterprise of saving the individual isolated and disembodied soul," end quote. Not all churches, not even all LDS buildings, fall under Berry's indictment. In the last couple of years, I have had occasion to attend two different Protestant churches. I was struck by the difference I felt and saw with what I presently experienced and have experienced in nearly all of the LDS meeting houses I have attended since leaving Little Utah. In the first building, I attended a wedding and later a funeral. On both occasions, I was moved by the simple beauty of their worship area, or what is often called the sanctuary. The beauty came from the simplicity and the naturalness of the setting. What had been achieved was a design that allowed the beauty of a wooden lot to be seen through large plate glass windows without the distraction of nearby busy streets. In addition, natural light flooded the room, making it seem to me a wonderful place in which to pray, sing hymns, study the scriptures, and yes, even to say farewell to a cherished friend. In contrast, the chapel of my ward building has no windows and is lighted artificially. It seemed when I attended it next and subsequently dark and confining. Putting doctrine aside, the chapel in my meeting house does not facilitate the joy of worship or the restoration of one's soul, as did the Protestant church I visited on those two occasions. Later, my wife and I attended a community-sponsored workshop at another local church. The building was not elaborate and was, in fact, a metal prefab building. But the story the interior told was that it was home to an involved congregation. The members clearly perceived that the purpose of that building was more than a place to simply attend meetings, to receive instruction on one's duties and responsibilities. It seemed to me that this place was a center for the here and now as well as for hope in the future. There were tables with pamphlets and flyers on community activities that might be of interest to the members. The walls contained artwork by one of the members, and the classroom and corridors were full of the drawings and thoughts of the children. It reminded me of the refrigerator door of families with young children. It all verged on clutter, but it wasn't distracting. It looked lived in. I said to my wife that this building looks so used and enjoyed, whereas our philosophy seems to be to make our building look as though we have not yet moved in. I have come down pretty hard on what I have referred to as the standardization of the church, or to paraphrase Newman, the McDonaldization of the church's landscape. Newman also states in relationship to this McDonaldization concept that, quote, "A globalized world is not a multicultural world. It is one in which uniform standards are imposed by a small elite upon the rest, normally for their own economic benefit," end quote. None of us would accuse the church leaders of establishing such a strong centralized church government for personal economic gain or even for personal gratification. But we would ask the question, how has it occurred, or why did it occur? Perhaps we would ask what was gained. I think there are a number of reasons as to how it might have occurred I will mention too. The first, of course, is that the Lord revealed it to the prophet. Obviously, if I thought that, I would not be delivering this paper. But being the well-trained Mormon that I am, that is the answer I would give in the high priest priesthood class if the question came up. However, I am not aware of any revelation or set of revelations that would lead to the level of organizational specificity and centralization that we have today. As an aside, such revelations would not require pilot programs. Since there is no secure way to extract myself for why I don't think there are one or more revelations that frame the standardization we see in the church, I am simply going to my second reason with this one final observation. Most of the brethren come to their calling from corporate/management backgrounds. The second reason I wish to mention has to do with what I have heard referred to as a gospel culture. The proof text generally used is Paul's statement found in Galatians 3:28. "There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Christ Jesus," end quote. As we become one in Christ, we are freed from the limitations of local and regional cultures. In a practical sense, the gospel culture prescribes acceptable behavior for members of the LDS Church. It thereby makes it easy for members to fit in, no matter where they go. A family can move from one part of the country to another and never be strangers in their relationship to the church. All they need to do is identify the ward which they belong, attend the first Sunday, and they are home. They are no more strangers, but fellow citizens with the saints. That is a remarkable organizational achievement and certainly a program benefit. Next, the family waits patiently for the Lord to reveal to the bishop how they are to serve. That, too, is a powerful organizational concept that contributes to the orderliness of the operation. From this gospel perspective, what is important is truth perspective. From this gospel cultural perspective, what is important is truth restored. It is the true doctrine and ordinance of salvation that matters, and it supersedes, indeed supplants, geography, landscape, and culture. And in my lifetime, I have seen it happen. Although I see it and am amazed, I am likewise unsettled. I am unsettled because it is too easy. There are no pilgrimages. There are no journeys. There is just rank-and-file performance. I am unsettled because my awe of the Salt Lake Temple is greater for the biography of the place than for what transpires inside. The majesty is in what the people did at that place and their reasons for doing it. Theirs was the real worship. I am unsettled because I think we no longer experience religion or spirituality. We experience church. Wendell Berry writes of driving on the freeway in Kentucky. He writes, quote, "I was hardly aware of the country I was passing through because on the freeway one does not have to be. The landscape has been so that one may drive over it at 70 miles per hour without any concession whatsoever to one's whereabouts. One might as well be flying. Though one is in Kentucky, one is not experiencing Kentucky. One is experiencing the highway, which might be in nearly any hill country east of the Mississippi," end quote. Similarly, in church, we will receive the same fare in nearly any meeting in any state of the Union. Why do we think that a group of professional women on the Wasatch Front need the same Relief Society lesson as a group of farm wives on the bank of the Satilla River? You can't experience God where everything is already worked out for you. Even the young people, 16 and 17 years of age, as I discovered from teaching Sunday school, are convinced that all of the answers are already given. They may not have the answers themselves, but they are secure with their knowledge that the bishop or the prophet has them, and should they, the youth, ever need or want the answers to a troublesome question, they can be readily attained. Or, if the answer is not forthcoming, it is because they aren't needed. As one of my Sunday school scholars said when I asked if they ever wondered about their standing with the Lord, quote, "It crosses my mind, but I figure that as long as I am worthy to receive a temple recommend, I am okay," end quote. That from a young man heavily recruited by BYU for an academic scholarship. We are secure in a transcendent gospel culture. Are we secure in a transcendent gospel culture, or are we edging closer and closer to not knowing where we are, or perhaps who we are? In response, I hear a voice declaring that the church and the members are faring quite well, thank you very much. But I am not personally reassured. I am even less reassured when I think of the lines of the hymn from our hymn, The Wintry Day, quote, "I cannot go to rest, but linger still in meditation at my window sill. While like the twinkling stars in heaven's dome, come one by one sweet memories of home. And would thou ask where my fancy roves to reproduce the happy scenes it loves," end quote. I do not know what scenes of home, what happy memories of youth of today will reproduce when they reach my age. They most likely will not have a church home place as I do. And with that, what is the final chapter of Little Utah's biography? The building was sold several years ago to another church denomination, and it was moved to another site. The LDS congregation moved to a new standard-issue building in town. There they do all they can to accomplish the tasks that others set for them. The meeting place in town is not called Little Utah, but the Pearson Ward. Little Utah Church was never a Little Utah. However, the church in town is more Utah in culture than drawl aside, and could easily be known as a Little Utah, as could the other wards of the state. At the old site where the country church sat, a monument has been erected in memory of those early members who raised the money and built the church as a home for their fledgling religious community. It is fitting, I think, that the monument was conceived and erected and financed by descendants of those early members. It is disconcerting that no such monument will ever be or could be erected at the LDS building in town.
Okay, we have, more than that, 17 minutes for questions. And Parker, I don't know if you want to repeat everyone's question or if we want to distribute the microphone. Okay. Yeah, Bernice? I guess you're going to have to repeat.
What you said about growing up in a small country church, while I'm sure it's different than growing up in Washington, D.C., there was still, it was a small community in a large non-Mormon community. I do think one of the strengths of the church is its primary. I have a daughter-in-law who joined the church, and strength of what she observed in the primary, and that's a wonderfully creative organization that I don't think the priesthood has glommed onto yet. I have another daughter-in-law who lives in Utah County in a ward where there are 200 children in the primary, and she's the primary president. But she is full of ideas, and it's a standard procedure that all the children are to stop by at her house anytime for a treat, so she can get to know them all. And she just is right there, and her children are going to have wonderful memories of growing up in this community because she's made it a community. I don't see this as much as the membership gets older, and by the time they get to be high priests, the men are making jokes about how boring it is. So something happens on the way, but thank you for sharing.
I might, add that Bruce made some of the same comments this morning in his remarks about growing up in Washington.
I was very interested to listen to your talk. I wonder if in that small community where you did not have a lot of immediate access, telephone calls to the regional representative and things like that all the time, do you feel like that there was more comfort with free thinkers to be themselves within the group?
Well, we weren't the intelligentsia, but the people were quite comfortable with being who they were. That's what they were. They were who they were. You know, they were Southerners, and they were Southerners who were Mormons. And they bridged that, but they weren't just exclusively Mormons. See, they were Southerners at the same time, and they couldn't escape that somehow or another. And I didn't emphasize; I just mentioned it. Somehow or another, the church simply will take it, supersedes whatever the indigenous culture is anymore. In fact, Exponent 2 and read about two lines, and discovered that same point by a person elsewhere. So.
Any other question? I got a question here myself. I'm actually serving the role of the teacher's corpsman in Fast and Testimony meeting, aren't I? You referred to something called center stakes. Do you want to expound on what that means?
Maybe that's just a term that... what's the word I want? Imaginative BYU... Center stakes, the center stakes of Zion. And, I dropped the line from this article, this paper, and I regret it. I'll just say it was a place. Zion is no longer a place in our reconceptualization. It's wherever you are. See, but there was a time when place was so important to the church, but it's no longer important except as here's a historical place, see. But current places aren't important.
Other questions? Yeah, Dan.
Very poorly formed. Basically, starting with what you said, and then I want to throw a hypothesis out there, or at least a thought. I can't remember the full story, but I remember the first and the third stage of this study. But I think it was Thomas O'Day who judged that to be a good Mormon in the early church, all you needed to do was be loyal to Joseph Smith. Actually, the second one is, I do now remember it. The second one is that you could be whoever you want as long as you would help build the kingdom. So, you know, it's a doc, you could believe whatever you want, but as long as you were willing there, especially in Utah and the Great Basin, to boo that, no one thought twice about you. Third emphasis, and the one that I'm wondering if where your question came from, is the third emphasis today is doctrinal conformity, the ability to testify in the standard way with the three. You know, I know that the Book of Mormon is, you know, Joseph Smith's a prophet, Book of Mormon is true, the current leaders and so on and so forth. So I'm just wondering, I'm guessing that here in the 20th century, the early 20th century, you guys were still in a model that was switching elsewhere. You were who you were, you were willing to serve this, you were loyal, and so therefore we can put up with all your idiosyncrasies and all that. And I thought that was a little bit fascinating. And then I do have a thought experiment for a minute.
I think you're exactly right. We were in that state. The church had not, this would be offensive to some people, but the church had not consumed us. You know, it was a vital part of our lives, but we weren't a lot different from other people's churches. You know, I mean, here was this community, but we had a life in some sense that while we were Mormons 24 hours of the day, we weren't just absolutely consumed by the organization of the church and the demands of the church. So it was a different kind of feel to it. See, I mean, even knowing we were LDS and going to LDS activities, we were doing that in some sort of broader concept. I mean, it wasn't as narrow, and I don't mean that we probably were quite provincial, but it wasn't this narrow slice because we were interacting with everybody in our community across the board. I can remember a time in my, I remember a friend of mine saying to me, it was Sunday evening, we were meeting with a group of LDS for some reason, a small group, sort of a semi-social thing. He and his wife were out of town, they'd been to a convention. It's such a relief to be back among the LDS people, he was saying, and I understood exactly what he was saying. You know, I said to him, I can remember words so plainly, I said to him, I'd rather be at a hot dog roast with Mormons than the finest banquet with non-Mormons. Well, I tell you, I've come to a different, I mean, I gave that up, thank the Lord. I like people. You know, I love people. I've gone back to my youth, and I just take them wherever they are. In fact, non-Mormons are so refreshing. I know Bruce is refreshing.
Yeah, the food is better, too. I took the Unitarian Church in my area offered a class on dealing with your former religious tradition. And the exercise that the minister took everybody through was visualize your meeting place, visualize the church that you grew up in, and what does that mean? And then you sort of, what is the meanings, you went through what the meanings were. And I realized what had happened was I visualized my home ward, and the ward I grew up in, the Chevy Chase ward, is not a standard building. It was built before the church, and things were built for specific purposes. And I could trace the theology of the church I grew up in that architecture, the way it was laid out. And I was struck that remembering that part of the difficulties I have with all the major is that architecture was gone. And every church I went to after that was a standardized church, which had a different theology, different layout, and it was all the same everywhere I went. I wondered, to what extent do we, by shaping our buildings the way we do, are we changing our religion and changing our theology just with bricks and mortar?
That's a great question, and I don't have an answer to say except what I'm saying is it's happening. You know, as our buildings have become nondescript in some sense, and they've been given to us, we've likewise lost our voice, at least in my opinion. And I'll illustrate this with an experience actually with the Unitarian Church. My wife said to me, I want to attend the Unitarian Church. And I said, why? She said, I just want to go. So we went to sacrament meeting. We got up and left sacrament meeting, went over to the Unitarian Church. We were conspicuous. We were dressed in Mormon attire. I had on my blue suit, my white shirt, my tie. She had on her appropriate church. Everyone else was just as casual as I am. And so they said, oh, you're visitors. And how can you tell? That service that day was the end of summer, early fall, and what they had done was everyone brought in little vials or bottles of water, and they were bringing significant water experiences that they had. I remember one man brought some, and they poured it into a bowl, a community bowl of water. He brought water from his swimming pool where his children and now his grandchildren swam and had so many fond memories. Others brought water from the ocean where they had gone as a family vacation. Others brought water that had meaningful experience to them. And I suspect all of us can identify some body of water that has some meaning to us. And they would bring it up, pour it in this community bowl and talk about it. And then the minister gave some homily about the water and blending the water. Can you imagine that happening in an LDS church? Can you imagine a bishop inviting that to happen? And it wouldn't. Well, the second thing is because we were there, we get the newsletter. Nobody ever has recruited us to come to church. They just simply put us on their mailing list. Well, I see these interesting things going on. So-and-so is going to have a book discussion. Anybody interested, come. Now, imagine having a book discussion in your ward. You have to go to the bishop, the state president, you know, and they would be afraid to approve it. Is the book church approved or not? Well, it doesn't fit with the program. You're never going to have a spontaneous book discussion. So you got a standardized building with standardized program with no room to vary. You just go and do what you're supposed to do. Now, I know that's dark, and I'm probably being excessive in some sense. But my wife reminds me that radicals help us to revisit our own position. Okay. So maybe that's what I'm doing.
Gary, I guess we might be able to make it.
I came in a little late, but I was interested. Bernice and I have a good friend who became a mission president, and then right after that was called to the Second Quorum of 70. And so we talked to them occasionally, and Bernice had a conversation with Steve's wife, Martha. And Martha said, you know, in this position, we have a whole new concept of the idea of belonging to the church. And I was thinking, that applies not only to people at the higher levels, but to all of us now. Belonging to the church is really means something more than it did 20, 30, and 40 years ago.
Dan, you had a thought you were going to...
Yeah, and in fact, your last comments even did that. My query, if anybody wants to bite on this question or something, would be, it seems to me almost a matter of trust. The fact that, you know, back you were talking about, you knew the person, you just trusted the person, their integrity, their heart, the fact that they were loyal to the church. And I was wondering if anybody saw any hopes for that sort of level of trust to head back to local congregations, or is it because of the modern world where you don't even have, you know, you're not even able to give your loyalty to your work place and expect to have that job for life, you know, time like you could back there? I don't know. Will we ever trust again so that local stuff and local flavors can jump back up?
Do you see any upside to this McDonaldization of church architecture or place?
Terrifically efficient organization. Organizationally, it's powerful and efficient, and you know, obviously, you save tremendous amounts of money by having these building plans.
But do you see that as an upside?
No. No, I do not. No, no, of course not. I do not. I want to propose something to Dan. I want to do a symposium called The Rabbi Visit Sunstone. Do you know the rabbi books, any of you? Yeah, they're always a murder mystery. The rabbi missed... Yeah, right. That's exactly right. Well, this author, and I can't remember his name, but anyway, he uses this as the mysteries themselves are... You know, but he uses it as a vehicle to deal with Judaism. But he also openly talks about the politics of this particular synagogue. You know, and it's just rampant, it's wild. And here's the concept. If you have two Jews together, you'll have at least three opinions. All right. Now, on the other hand, and I've been working on this, if you have two Mormons together, you have one opinion. It's what do the brethren think? All right. You know, when I first started reading these rabbi books, I thought, that never happened in my church. Boy, isn't that wonder how good we are? We don't have... And then I started thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had to get these gut levels and fight them out and wrestle with them and argue over what the building's going to look? How do you gain the Spirit if you don't put yourself in the hands of the Lord? You know, if somebody else knows what you're supposed to do all the time, then how do you ever do that wrestling with the Lord? I think, yeah, let's have some chaos in the church and let people find spirituality. Really deep, gut-wrenching spirituality.
That would be a disappointing place.
Yeah. Okay, one last question, and I think our time is up, Rebecca.
I agree overwhelmingly with what you've said, and it resonates with my own experience, and I have all that nostalgia of the way it was and never will be for my children and how sad that makes me. But I can't give up. We do have a book club in our ward, and it's the one place that dental student wives and people like me can get together and talk about something on neutral territory. We call it I've heard this is a good book club because so often nobody reads. It's a start, and I think that's important. I've taken it upon myself the last 5 or 6 years to give a party every 4th of July. And we invite the whole darn ward. And if you don't want to come, you don't have to come, but everybody's invited. And it's not part of any correlated program, but it's open to everybody. Last Christmas, because we have so many students on our ward, and they all go home, you know, because that's where Christmas is, I gave a home for the holidays party. And if home was here, you come to my home, and we'll have that Sunday evening right before Christmas at my house. And there were people I'd never seen before, but they were so grateful to have somewhere to go because they were homesick and this was hard. And so I thought, you don't always have to be called. You don't always have to be part of somebody's program. You don't have to fill in somebody's chart to find something to do to make a difference. I'm thinking of a family that lived in the South to go to school, and they said there was a sister in that ward who invited every new couple to dinner. Everyone, you know, for decades, all the new kids that came through got an invitation to her home for dinner. And so sometimes you can find ways to get outside the box and still make a difference if you're not ready to give up.
I appreciate what you're saying, but you hear what you're saying is that individuals can get outside the box. They can't do it within the box. See, the bishop ought to be saying, does anybody have any good ideas for a book? Let's have a book discussion next Sunday after sacrament meeting, if anybody wants to. And that not even, you know, but goodness gracious, no. So that's, you have to work. But you're not enhancing the LDS theology. You're just enhancing your own life, which you should be doing. But it's outside the formal domain of the church.
Okay.
I should have the last word.
Well, I'm holding the microphone, and I have absolutely no thought. But if anyone wants to have a last word, that I think that's great. Otherwise, we will.
Thank you.
We will thank you. Thank Parker for coming. Thanks.